You're listening to Our Town in Sound.
Perhaps you could identify some of the people on there.
Cause I can tell you all of them if you want to know. That's Mr. Thorpe. He was called Shampty Thorpe. He was a very fine mechanic. Here is the river with the snow, as you see, down there. And there was a lovely line of trees there. Copper Beech, I think.
Yes, they're all gone.
They're all gone, yes.
In 1931, there was a great pageant here, which the whole town, more or less, was involved in. Everybody was making costumes, involved in ticket selling and publicity and so on like that.
Oh, I learned all the local gossip, for God's sake. I spent my life learning local gossip.
History, memories and gossip about a small Suffolk town. This CD has its origins in an audio guide we made for the Framlingham Town Trail in 2007, featuring the voices of over 30 local people. We've decided to re-edit this material to include some recently discovered private recordings made by the author John Bridges. One in particular is from 1974 and captures John quizzing the late Harold Landman, founder of the local museum, about some early Framlingham photographs. Mr. Landman was then in his 80s and was inspired to recall history, memories and gossip about a small Suffolk town, but as it was 100 years ago. I think you'll agree this gives a touching new dimension to the modern interviews as we evoke our town in sound.
Is it recording my voice now?
Yes. Don't worry.
This is Bridge Street, Framlingham, with Percy Allen's butcher's shop and the house where I was born there.
Yes.
And this is the old police station here. That's the Unitarian Chapel.
Framlingham is magnificent, with the castle and the church, and there's so much to see.
I'm fairly new to the town, been here just over a year now, and I'm really enjoying it. The people here are lovely and fantastic little array of shops, so you never need to leave the town, really.
We wanted a bolt hole to come out to, and so we came up here and we decided that Framlingham was the ideal place because it had a church, a castle, a large pond, and many, many pubs.
Interesting, it's the early days of
it. So exciting to have, you know, a chemist and a doctor and a dentist and dry cleaners on your doorstep. Where I lived before was very rural, and we just had a pub, and that was it. So moving to Framlingham was, it's like a big city to me.
Motor car here outside the butcher's shop, and of course all the elm trees are gone. There used to be a lot of elm trees around the sale yard in the distance, you see.
There was a time when I worked at Carly and Webb with my uncle. We could walk out the door, we'd know everybody who came up. Now I'm afraid it's very, very few. There are so many houses being built in the town and many more to come that there are you know a lot, but you don't know all of them.
It was Bob Hawes. He was the son of the horse from the Crown and Anchor. He kept that pub. When the war was declared, everything in the trade went flat. We hadn't got the work.
There's a few. There's good old Fred who works at Fram College. He's a brilliant Suffolk boy. But there's not many of us now. But Framlingham has changed, there's no doubt about it. Whether it's changed for the better, I don't know.
We have a record going back 454 years. The oldest bells, we're not quite certain how old they are, but they're certainly mid-15th century. So when we're ringing on a Tuesday night for practice, we're handing bells that were cast over 450 years ago. It's quite a thought, really.
My name's Tony Martin. I've lived here now 10.5 years, but I've actually had an interest in Framlingham for a lot longer than that, because I came to college when I was about just under 10, had my 10th birthday up there. And I'm here, and I love Framlingham because my grandfather was born here, and his father came here in 1865 to be clerk to the solicitor. I sometimes think when you walk around, if you look up rather than sort of look where you're going, then you can see things up above the street level, which were there in my grandfather's time and his father's time. And you can see a lot of the bits and pieces left over.
So let's now explore Framlingham, both past and present, following roughly the route of the town trail. The town trail officially starts in the Elms car park, but for the first port of call, ideally we ought to join these people touring the town museum in the castle.
There's a horseshoe there, rather big horseshoe there.
So the horses could walk on lawns and cut things like bowling greens and so on without cutting it out with their hooves.
Its curator is Alison Pickup.
The museum was founded by a collection from the late Harold Lamman of ephemera, bits and pieces that nobody normally bothers to collect, from sort of late Victorian, early Edwardian.
You see the handcuffs?
Where?
They're up there on the right, there's some handcuffs.
Can't
be bothered. Come on, I'll show you.
Carry me in.
Since which time it's been expanded with all sorts of other things that people have kindly donated, we've bought, we've got grant money for, to extend the time period back to medieval, and hopefully up into the present, because people still aren't collecting bus tickets, etc., and they will be needed later.
The Framlingham Weekly. News.
I give a clearer picture of what Framlingham was like when it was a more industrial, busy, working town, rather more than it is now, which is really a commuter town for Ipswich and just small local businesses serving the needs of the populace rather than actually producing anything much. If you think the Bibby Mill's gone, that's probably the last bit of production in Fram has gone, which is a pity, but such is life.
I wonder if they've seen those splendid black and white photos over there.
These were taken by a gentleman by the name of John Self, whose shop can still be seen, which is now the shoe shop in Framlingham if you go for a walk around the town. He took a lot of photographs on glass, and these are prints off from the negatives. Again, it's a fun thing to do, is to walk around the town, look at the photographs and try and identify which they are.
This one, of course, is Wilclough Square, Mr. John Self's shop, and the tailor's shop there.
That must be fairly old, that,
yeah,
I imagine.
Yes, fairly old, because the condition of the roads denote that, you see.
Yes.
And on market day, you would have seen all the carts here and the horses put up in the stables at the back of White Horse, you see.
Elms car park. This is where we come at night to dispose of all those virgin olive oil bottles that accumulate. Actually, the view from the bottle bank neatly encapsulates modern and traditional Fram. To the right are new builds, to the left the Robert Hitchum almshouses, and on the breeze the chatter of the Robert Hitchum Primary School. From that you'll gather Mr. Hitchum was an important figure in Framlingham's history.
He left Framlingham to his old college, Pembroke, and if they didn't want it, then it was to be left to another college, and of course Pembroke said they would have it, so that is why Pembroke College are lords of the manor today.
Now, Robert Hitchum had an interesting life. He was a lawyer to Queen Anne and senior sergeant to James I. He bought Framlingham Castle and its estate from the second Earl of Suffolk in 1635, and before he died he made a will that was to have profound consequences for Framlingham. But as Tony Martin explains, Robert Hitchum's will soon began to cause legal migraines.
Well, it was an impossible will because he left instructions that the children from Coggeshall and Debenham and Framlingham were to be educated in a school at Framlingham, which he left money to be built. Nobody ever understood how the children from Coggeshall were going to come to Framlingham to be educated.
Drive point 1 mile, then turn right.
The problem is this. My little 21st century device here says that it's going to take me 1 hour and 4 minutes by car. And we're not going on 16th century roads either.
Recalculating.
Drive point it's odd that one lawyers mile, sometimes don't make very good wills. Right.
In the end, it needed none other than the intervention of Oliver Cromwell to sort out the many loose ends. Let's now head up towards Wellclose Square and past the almshouses.
They are a result of Hitchum's will, and he left instructions that the 8 almshouses were to be built for elderly people in Framlingham in need. They all had their own uniform, and there was a bench in church where they sat when they had to go there wearing their Hitchum's coats.
Visitors to Framlingham make a beeline for the castle, but actually the almshouses were made from castle masonry, another clause in Mr. Hitchum's will, which is why there's rather less castle now than there once was.
The building contracts for that survived incidentally, including taking down the buildings in the castle and reassembling them on the site, and there were building costs. The names of the blokes who built it, the specification of the lot in Pembroke College Library.
That was the voice of local historian Dr. John Ridgard, who will be doing his best to keep this CD on the scholarly straight and narrow. The town trail now heads for Riverside, which opens with a blaze of late 20th century supermarket architecture.
I think Riverside is now a bit bland. There was a very nice house opposite the United Reformed Church on the other side of the river, and there's pictures of that with people in their cottage garden, and they were very beautiful houses, and a lot of people even now express regret that they had to be knocked down.
Here is the river with the snow, as you see, yeah. Down there, and there was a lovely line of trees there, Copper Beech, I
think. Yes, they're all gone now.
They're all gone, yes.
When author John Bridges was compiling his book of Framlingham photos, he found quite a few that showed this part of the town underwater.
Yes, a lot of the photographs do show floods, and I think it was relatively common. I'm not really sure why it flooded, presumably because the river was really not clear enough to let the mass of floodwater that came through the meres to really had to all escape along the river out of Fram, and it was really not up to it.
No, it doesn't happen so much now. If you get a sudden sharp rain, there doesn't seem to be sufficient drainage in Albert Place, but it doesn't flood up to the axles of carts like it used to be.
There's a photograph which shows where the tanyard was, which then became the East Anglia electricity supply place, so that's where they had their generators in. There's a lovely picture there. It's completely flooded, and in fact the engines that provided the power to the generators when it did flood, they would just cut out and the town would then be without electricity.
Might I tell you rather an amusing incident that
yes,
took place?
Certainly.
A man living down here used to let out horses harnessed to a broom, you see, a broom, that's a carriage. Well, this Mr. Wright sent a boy along to order a broom, you see,
yes.
A broom to sweep with.
Oh, I see.
Well, at 2 o'clock that afternoon, the brougham with the horse and the driver was waiting outside Mr. Wright's shop for him to pick up Mr. Wright to take him.
Lovely.
And we can't leave Riverside without remarking on the Black Pump, which is now immortalised in the Framlingham town sign.
Yes, it's quite an old one. That's a spring pump with the two spouts, you see.
Yes.
They used to screw something into the bottom spout and then the water would rise to the top spout for filling.
I don't know, I suppose it got the water out of the river because it got two spouts. And one was for the people to fill their buckets from, obviously a convenient level. and the other one you put a pipe on and it used to fill a water cart, and so that they would go around the streets and lay the dust.
We now head up Station Road on our tour towards Thomas Mills' garden tomb. This is where much of New Framlingham is being built. So how has the population changed in Fram?
See, Framlingham more or less at the beginning of the medieval period pushing 1,000 perhaps, of which the castle itself was really quite well populated. You think of perhaps 200 people living there by the time everybody's counted in.
Framlingham, let's not forget, was a power centre for much of its early history.
Population grew very quickly, and I think you're talking about 1500 to 2000 for most of the medieval period, except when it got cut in half by the Black Death in 1349, for example.
In actual fact, it hasn't grown as much as one might think, because in 1851 the population was just under 2,500.
Most days you'll see this lady scooting around Framlingham on her push bike.
I'm Stephanie Bennell, and I'm chairman of Framlingham Town Council, amongst other things. The density has changed. So whereas before you'd have cottages with perhaps parents and six or seven children in, now there'd be only one person living in that cottage.
In the 50s and 60s it was really quite low. It certainly dropped below 2,000, and I think from the 70s and 80s onwards it's slowly sort of obviously increasing because of the new housing estates that have been built. So naturally the numbers have gone up, and I think the present number is a bit in excess of 3,000.
John Bridges has now brought us past the second set of almshouses, which bear the name of another great benefactor of the town, Thomas Mills. He was laid to rest in his garden over there in that huge tomb.
Thomas Mills was a wheelwright, and he did very well, and he was a dissenter, and obviously that's why his tomb is in his front garden, because he didn't wish to be buried in any church or chapel. And he left a considerable endowment to the town, built the almshouses under the terms of his will, and it is now a very wealthy trust, because they owned a lot of the land, what Thomas Mills did, had his farm and so on, behind the almshouses, and of course that is now all where modern Fram is being developed into for domestic use.
Let's travel on around the bend towards the site of the former railway station.
But the roads were unmade, were they?
Huh?
The roads were all unmade, were they?
Oh, yes. Their holes were filled up with those stones from the fields, from the farmers.
So it was just a dust track, like?
Yes.
I mean, the road to out to Wicker Market would have been just a...
That was the 90-year-old Morgan Watts back in 1985, recalling the early days of motoring. And before the railway, things were far worse.
The road conditions were really pretty dire at the time, so to take goods to London would take sort of 2 or 3 days. I think there was Mr. Noller. He would come through Framlingham on a Thursday evening with his cargo of dead meat for the markets, and then he would go to make his way slowly down to London, where he would arrive on Saturday morning. So you can imagine, if you thought you'd... have a lift with him, you had a very unpleasant journey.
The railway opened on June the 1st, 1859, and connected Framlingham to what we now call the East Suffolk Line at Campsie Ash.
Coal became cheaper because it could be brought straight to the town, and also the corn merchants' business, which were all centred around the station, they were able to transport the barley and the wheat to very distant places. And particularly in the early years of the 20th century, Clark's, for example, were sending malting barley to distant breweries in very great quantities. In fact, they were the biggest merchants, certainly in East Anglia, if not beyond that.
It wasn't just local trade that benefited.
The construction of the college is almost coincidental with the railway, which opened in 1859.
This is Mark Robinson, Head of History at Framlingham College.
strange as it may sound, it wasn't the exclusive preserve of people within this immediate locality. Another thing that was highlighted in the original prospectus was the fact that it was 90¼ miles from London. So I guess the idea was that they could entice people from the smog of London out into the countryside. They highlighted the fact that the dormitories were spacious and airy, and so that was, I guess, part of the appeal.
As the 20th century moved on, demand collapsed, and the last regular passenger train left Framlingham at 6:53 p.m. on Saturday, the 1st of November, 1952. The college continued to charter a special train at the beginning and end of each term. The story goes that a few years later, British Rail put on one of its only two familiar displays of mechanical efficiency. The train missed all of its connections, surprise, surprise, whereupon the college cancelled the contract.
I did go on it once from school. I don't know why. My parents weren't able to collect me from school because we only lived in Ipswich. And I did go once on the train, and I wish I'd taken more notice of the journey that I made.
If you want to see some Framlingham Railway memorabilia, check out the Station Hotel, which was also built in 1859. A few years back, this pub seemed on its last legs, but then John and Claire Bjornsen took over to make it one of the glories of the town.
It wasn't just restored, it was changed as well as restored. And we lived above and ran the pub for a few years and then put in tenants who have carried on the good work.
Good food?
Well, we've always tried to do good food. When we were here actually running it, it was very much home cooking, hopefully of a good quality with fresh ingredients. But then all the tenants that come in the pub since have been good at promoting the food and, in fact, improving the food. But Mike, who's here now, has just done an outstanding job, and he has now made it into an extremely popular food pub.
The town trail now requests that we make a U-turn, so let's return past the Railway Inn pub, turn right up 4th Street, left opposite the Catholic Church, and then up Queenshead Alley, the medieval gateway to Framlingham. If you know Framlingham, you'll realise I'm exaggerating. Far from the Grand Gate of Kiev, the entrance at Queenshead Alley is a mere 2'6" across. But then again, Kiev never had a delicatessen like Leo's on the right-hand side. And trust me, their red onion and goat's cheese tart is one of the great marvels of Suffolk catering. But we've now reached the heart of Framlingham, Market Hill.
Framlingham was a borough, a thriving medieval borough, and didn't let go its burgesses altogether until the middle of the 19th century. Probably a mistake. But you have to think of the marketplace not as an open area as it is now, more or less, but as an area where they, even on non-market days, there were sheds and bits and pieces standing on the market, and most of all, a very large market hall.
It's Saturday and a market day. That means plenty of customers of Victoria Bell's second-hand bookshop.
We've been here nearly 30 years. It's got a stock of, sort of say, I don't know, 8,000-10,000 books, starting at cheap paperbacks, going on to more expensive hardbacks and some antiquarian old stuff. We try and have something in here for everybody.
Looks like we've got an itinerant musician here today.
It's obviously very busy, and I think the market on Saturday mornings now is very much a great social occasion in Framlingham. Everybody goes down, has coffee in the crowd, and at the Dancing Goat Cafe and so on, and the walkabout. I don't know how much trade is done. I'm sure there's enough for the traders, but it's a good social occasion.
Yeah, it is a good market. It brings in a lot of people from quite a wide area, and it seems to be enjoyed by everybody. And, you know, there are some good stalls selling some good local produce, and local furniture makers, plants, eggs, as well as all the sort of meat and things. So, you know, it's a good mixed market and people enjoy it.
My name's Darren Smith and I'm the fishmonger on Framlingham Market. Mm-hmm. I'm the market supervisor. Sort the market out, tell people where to go, collect the rents, etc. Mm-hmm.
I'm Roger Wint. Yeah, I've been doing the market 35 years. Well, it has changed a lot because people are getting more into homegrown vegetables, and I do a lot of plants, what people come and buy. And we've quite a lot of cut flowers we grow as well. Wide selection all through the summer of homegrown produce and plants.
All the fish comes from Lowestoft, but it comes from all around the world. I mean, I'll try and buy local where I can. It's not so much local fish now. I mean, Lowestoft is a port shrinking all the time. The fish does come from other ports, Scarborough, Grimsby, Scotland, all around the country.
There's some lovely letters in the Pembroke College Library again. I mean, people complaining because they had to, as they walked down the street, they had to step over animal remains and blood coming out the butcher's doors. But it's all about drainage, and the market was really quite interesting.
This is really memories from George Cooper, who lived in the town for many years, and he recalled as a young boy when he lived just on the Market Hill. When the circus came to town, this is really the most exciting thing for a young boy, he said, because the marquee was set up, which covered pretty much the whole of the Market Hill. He said they had lions and tigers and things like that in their cages, and he said they would roar throughout the night, and he said, I just never slept all the time they were there.
Down the slope there is the famed village sign. Can you see the pump we passed earlier? And there's also representations of the church, a castle, and an octagonal postbox.
I think we're going back to the 1990s. All of that was organised by the Framlingham WI. So they raised the money for it. They commissioned the designer, who was Mary Moore, who has designed a lot of the village signs around here. And it's been there ever since, and it's the most photographed sign ever, I should think.
We're now approaching the entrance to our supermarket, through that former carriage archway there.
The one on the right, actually, was where the very famous surgeon Sir Henry Thompson was born and became surgeon to Queen Victoria and the Emperor Napoleon III, and specialised in operations and diseases of urinary tract, which is a Framlingham's claim to fame in the medical world.
He was born on the Market Hill at Framlingham, yeah. And his father wouldn't release him from the grocery business until he was 28. He went to London and studied, passed every exam he went in for.
In the next cabinet, one of our great notable Framlingham residents was Sir Henry Thompson, who was physician to Queen Victoria and her son when the Prince of Wales.
And he went from strength to strength and won all sorts of awards. He was knighted by the Queen, and then
he's got two beautiful bits of Fabergé, which are worth having a look at, that were given to him by Prince of Wales, who became Edward VII. And also there is a green and gold wick holder, which is a bit odd, you've never seen one, but beautiful things to look at. And perhaps of more interest to me anyway is a dinner menu for a dinner that he hosted, where the principal guest is written as George, who was the King George V, and the guest above Henry Thompson is actually Arthur Conan Doyle, who signed the menu as well. But he was definitely a local lad made good, this one.